Welcome, everybody. I've got the pleasure of inviting you to this session. It's interesting, you know, increasingly we get actuaries going, should we be using those old methods, or is all fantastic things happening with data analytics? Well, this is one of these sessions, so I think you're going to hear from, once I heard somebody say that this is the cleverest actuary in practice at the moment, so it's great. I think you're really going to hear some leading-edge stuff. In terms of his bio, Hugh Miller is a left-handed actuary at Taylor Fry, where he has worked for the past decade. During that time, he's been involved in a wide variety of projects across injury schemes. With a PhD in statistics, he has a particular interest in improving the models and techniques used in actuarial work. And he also applies these techniques to corporate analytic projects and has been technical lead of Taylor Fry's annual evaluation of the New Zealand welfare system. He was the finalist for the ANZIIF 2017 Young Insurance Professional of the Year, definitively proving he is both young and professional. So with that, I'd like to hand over to Hugh, and it'll be great to hear his thoughts on this interesting building better PPAC models. Thanks, Hugh.
Thanks very much, Elaine. And thanks for turning up. There's a few golden rules as being an actuary that I've been able to identify so far. So one is to be nice to other actuaries because it's a fairly small sort of employment pool. Another is to be nice to institute staff, which will make your life a lot easier. And the third is to not present technical papers at the Injury and Disability Scheme seminar because they're poorly attended. So thank you very much for attending. I do appreciate it. And I do actually think this talk, sort of this is the right conference for the talk, because it's about sort of long-tailed reserving methods and actuaries, sort of fundamentally one of our jobs is doing that sort of work. So this is another reserving talk, and I think it comes out of a perception I have, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of technical innovation around and about sort of stochastic triangles and using generalized linear models, or GLMs, to sort of fit these reserving models that historically were used sort of old-fashioned aggregate methods to fit. And I think there was a lot of excitement at that time, but in practice, things have gotten stuck. And so a lot of actuaries have sort of shrugged and sort of kept doing similar things. And a lot of the promise, I think, offered by those approaches have not really materialised. So the question is, why has that happened? It's not because everybody else is wrong. It's because there are good reasons, I think. One is that there's an ease and control offered by Microsoft Excel. So if something doesn't look right, if you're using Excel and doing traditional triangle work, you can actually just edit the assumptions to make it look less unwell, I guess. There's also sort of speed and budget considerations. So if there's not a clear value add to the client, then if you can do it sort of faster and cheaper in an aggregate method, then that's a strong argument. And that value add question, I think there's a real question there, is sort of whether doing things in a more model-based or sort of stochastic framework is actually useful in terms of sort of understanding what's happening in a system and adding value to a client. There are also practical issues around these things. So sometimes people attempt these models and say, oh, well, actually, I can't do things as well as I could do before. This is actually quite hard. And so there are some practical issues. And there's also, of course, a familiarity bias. So if you've always done sort of simple aggregate triangles in Excel and sort of modelled with them, that's what you're comfortable with, and that's what you'll continue doing. So this talk today is sort of an odd talk in some ways, but it aims to address the last two in particular. So some of the practical issues that you sort of encounter when you try and use GLMs for reserving work, as well as sort of a familiarity bias sort of, I guess, buster, in the sense that if you haven't seen a lot of this stuff before, and some of you will have, it'll be a useful, hopefully, talk in terms of understanding how to sort of convert your thinking from an aggregate method to something that's a bit more formal statistically. So in that sense, a lot of it is reprise. So if you've sort of studied the topic before, some of it will be familiar. But there are some modest, I guess, contributions and things that I think are new that you perhaps wouldn't have seen before. So I deliberately titled the talk Better PPAC Models as a way of sort of not accidentally attracting people who wouldn't know what a PPAC model is. So I assume you all know what a PPAC model is. So it's a payment per active claim model, and it's a very common way to model workers' compensation payments and other sort of benefit schemes. So the idea is you've got two triangles. So you've got the number of actives in any given cell and the payments per active claim. So you usually set things up as a triangle. So the rows of the triangle are the accident years, so what year were you injured? And the columns are development years, so how many years since you were injured. So it forms a triangle because for older accident years, you've got more years to observe. And the aim is to complete the triangle, so to fill out the grey area, if that makes sense. So actives is generally some definition that you make up. So whether you've got a payment on a claim, for instance, you might decide it's active that year, or whether it's open, or some other sort of definition of activity, which sort of forms a useful denominator to model over time. And then payments per active claim is obviously sort of the total payments attributable to that cell divided by the number of actives. So usually you get a table, sort of a couple of triangles that look like that. So you get the upper half and you aim to estimate the lower half. And you do that by estimating factors and applying those factors. So the continuance rate factors are what we've shown at the bottom. So typically you might take the average continuance rate, and by that I mean the sort of numbers in one column divided by the corresponding numbers in the previous column, and that's sort of how many continue to be active in the next development period. And so you could take that over all rows, or you could take that over the last two rows if you think that's more relevant, or the last four rows. And so people would typically look at a few of those assumptions and say, well, I like that one, let's select that one. And so there's sort of a selection that then gets applied, and you sort of use that factor to multiply through to get the grey areas. Similarly with the payments per active, it's about taking averages, looking at trends, and sort of picking a number that you think is reasonable. Any questions on that? I'm happy to take questions as we go. All right. So it is a technical talk, so I'm going to introduce some notation. So I'll keep it to a minimum where I can. But throughout, I'm going to index the accident years by I and the columns by J. By adding I and J together, you get the payment year diagonal, which I'll call K. The continuance rate is going to be CJ. So typically, you have a continuance rate that varies by column, so it just has a J index. The number of active claims there, I've got NIJ. And the payments, I've got PIJ. So it's just sort of putting symbols where we had numbers there. So the first thing I want to talk about is how you sort of convert that triangle picture we had into a GLM context. So for some of you, that'll be incredibly easy. For some of you, this is sort of the first familiarity bias that you might sort of have to overcome. So the idea is that you need to convert the triangle into a flat file. So I've tried to illustrate that diagrammatically on the right there. So each row represents one cell of the upper half of the triangle that we had before. So for every combination of accident year and development year we had, that makes one row of the triangle. One row of the table. In each row, we have a response. So that's what we're trying to predict in the GLM context. And that's our continuance rate for that cell. So 73 divided by 105 corresponds to sort of development year 1 divided by development year 0 for that row. We also have a weight. And so the natural weight for this type of model is the number of active claims in the previous development period, because you're sort of asking the question of those, how many ended up continuing. So that's sort of a natural weight, and there are reasons why it is a natural weight as well. Finally, you need covariates. So these are the things that you're trying to sort of chuck into the model to estimate how your continuance rate changes over time or how it differs. And so what I've shown there is sort of some basic covariates you might want to add. So you might have an intercept term for an overall average. You might have indicator functions for J equals 1 and J equals 2. So that'll effectively give you a separate estimate for different development columns. So that's a very natural thing to do. In terms of the equations on the left, in a GLM, typically you're estimating a response variable as a function of your predictor variables. So the Xij there are our covariates that we have in our table. The betas are something that get generated by the GLM that have the relative sort of level and contribution of each of those covariates. And you've got this G inverse function. So they call that the link function. And the main job of the link function is to sort of transfer your predictions into a range that's plausible. So a continuance rate has to be positive. So a natural suggestion for a link function might be the exponential function, because that'll take some linear combination of terms, which could be positive or negative, and will ensure that it's positive. You also need to assume an error distribution. I'll come back to that in a second, but usually that's to say a statistical distribution, which is in some sense your expectation of the noise around the mean estimate that you're generating. So that's sort of a conversion from our PPAC model to our GLM. In a sense, it's pretty easy. You just need to create that flat file, which isn't too hard. VLOOKUP would do it for you in Excel. And then you need to pass it off to some sort of GLM fitting function and say, I want to fit these covariates with this distribution. And you'll get some answers popping out and some predictions that you can then apply to the lower half of the triangle. Conceptually, not too hard, I hope. So I'm going to give some example models to give a flavour for what you can do with a GLM that I hope is sort of relatively simple. So suppose that your covariate set is this set of indicator functions on the board here. So you've got an indicator function for the first development column, j equals 1. Remember, there's a zero column that we don't need a continuum trait for. The second covariate is j equals 2, and so on for all the columns in your data. So that's a very, very simple covariate matrix where you've basically got a set of discrete indicator functions that don't overlap with each other. And that will actually reproduce, using the weights that I mentioned on the previous slide, that will actually reproduce that row we had for the all volume-weighted average continuum trait. So you can actually reproduce your aggregate triangle very simply in a GLM context. And I guess that's my first point that I wanted to emphasise today, was that a GLM model actually reproduces the aggregate model without that much effort. And so at the very least, you're no worse off, and potentially you're better off. But what about this last three or last four approach? Well, I'm glad you asked. So here's a slightly uglier looking model. You can see that I've taken the original model, so j equals 1, j equals 2, j equals 3 indicator functions, and I've sort of doubled it. And so I've got one set of indicator functions for the last four rows. So k is greater than or equal to k, big K minus 3. So that's an indicator function saying whether I'm living in the last four diagonals, of my triangle. And then I've got equivalent indicator functions, which are sort of noise reduction terms, for the older ones. And so what that will actually reproduce, if you apply it, is that last four volume-weighted average. So I've managed to recreate effectively all the rows I had for possible selections in a GLM context, which is good. So if we couldn't do that, then you'd be a little bit worried. And so one obvious thing that you often do in a triangle context as well is once you start getting towards the right-hand side of your triangle, the data starts to thin out, so you might only have a few cases open. And so instead of having the column average, you might actually pull across a set of columns. And so that's an example that I've got here. So if you decide you want to sort of group a bunch of columns together, you just do that in the obvious way. So instead of having one indicator function for each column, you have one indicator function that spans a group of columns. And that's what I tried to express there. So I've sort of pulled the last five columns together so you'd have a single continuum trait for them. That sort of makes sense? Oh, nods. I like that. So the first result, and so there is a paper attached to this talk, of course. So if you are interested, please do read the paper. The first result in the paper effectively says you can choose any distribution you want for a GLM, and you'll still get all those reproductions of your chain ladder estimates and your volume weighted averages. So I guess even if you knew nothing about distributions, you could still reproduce everything you've done in Excel using triangles in a GLM context. So that's slightly reassuring that your ability to get things wrong is at least in some way reduced. However, that said, there are some common approaches. So Poisson is a common approach for continuum trait models, so that's a type of distribution. And gamma-type distributions are common for payment models. And so there's sort of a range of literature that argues why they are more sensible choices compared to others. So I guess it's worth saying that the reason why people worry about distributional choices is that they will help tell you about the relationship between the mean of the cell, which is what we've been talking about so far, and the variability in the cell, so how likely we are to see sort of high and low values and sort of volatility in each cell or each row or each column. So if you can get that right, then you can actually start doing other sorts of statistical tests, which are quite useful. So you can sort of figure out whether a particular step change is significant or not, which is actually quite useful when sort of talking about scheme changes and things like that. So that sort of I guess some of the power of a GLM are sort of once you've sort of done those first steps. The second result in the paper is actually around the topic of net continuance versus deactivation reactivation models. So one thing that I've glossed over up until now is you actually have a choice in modelling actives. You can either look at net activations, which is how many active claims you have compared to the previous period. So that's sort of what I presented. And another option that is actually looking at the rate of deactivation and the rate of reactivation separately. So you might look at, of the claims that were active last period, how many remain active, and of the claims that were not active, sort of closed effectively, how many reactivated. And so we've sort of tried various approaches in our office as sort of which way you go. Our general experience has been that deactivation and reactivation models tend to be a little bit more unstable and tricky to use. And the reason for that is that you're effectively adding two different trends together. If they're slightly out of alignment, you might have sort of the number of actives shooting up when it should be trailing off, or you might have the number of actives collapsing when it should be a bit more stable. And it turns out the statistics sort of back that up a little bit. So there's a little statistical argument hiding in the paper that says the one step ahead prediction is actually significantly more volatile or has higher variance if you're using a deactivation-reactivation model. So that's, a justification why the net activation model can be a bit more stable and easier to work with, which is good, I guess, because we'd kind of reached that conclusion informally in our office. It also suggests that there are better alternatives to a deactivation-reactivation model, which I won't really talk about today, if you do want to understand the claim opening and closing process. So the third result in the paper sort of is one practical issue that often comes up when you have zeros in the triangle. So I've sort of modified the triangle to give you an example of that. So if you have a zero in the first row, column development year three there, when you take the last two, last four, or all sort of average continuance rate, everything's fine because you're summing up some non-zero numbers in your denominator, and so you've got a numerator and a non-zero denominator, and you get a reasonable estimate. When you move that to a GLM context, remember we have one row per cell, so the continuance rate is undefined there, which can create sort of uncertainty as to what to do. The answer is that you can keep it in, set the zero to a very, very small number, delta, is, I think that's the official symbol for a small number, so 0.001. If you use that and have a net continuance rate for that cell, which is very high, offset by a very small weight, because remember the weight is effectively the denominator, then the statistics work out fine and everybody's happy, which is good. There's a slight sort of pro tip that if you are estimating the scale of the model, the scale parameter in the model, you have to use the deviance estimate instead of the Pearson estimate. That's sort of the type of thing that you have to go to the paper to understand. So they're the main theoretic results in the paper. Everything else in the paper is sort of a grab bag of ideas and thoughts on triangles, and so there's a few more of them. I should have been keeping track of time. Heaps. Yep. So one thing that's worth considering is that if you've gone to a GLM setup, you actually do have some alternative formulations. So a continuance rate is quite natural, I think, for a sort of a triangle setup. Another thing that's quite natural in a GLM setup is the cross-classified structure. So instead of estimating the continuance rate at each point, you're estimating the number of actives at each point. And you can do that because the GLM, in a sense, is a bit more powerful because it can sort of remember shapes a bit better than Excel can. The reason why you might want to do that is because continuance rates can actually be pretty wild. So a small decrease in continuance rates across the board will lead to a significant decrease in your overall reserve. And so anyone who's worked with these things for a long time sort of knows that you sort of vary continuance rates with great humility. Otherwise, you get sort of into trouble. So by modelling numbers directly, that actually does in some situations give you more control because you're thinking about the absolute level rather than the rate of change, which, I mean, clients can sometimes understand a little bit better as well. So that can be a useful thing to do. Usually if you do that, you need terms for both the development periods as well as the accident periods. And if you do that, generally things will sort of work out fine. But you do have to figure out exactly what you'll do for the transition between your leading diagonal to your first prediction column. So whether you sort of push it up or down a little bit. So I think that's sort of a useful point to make, even if you never use it. Another thing, which is sort of hinting at the fact that GLMs are more flexible and give you more power in theory, is that it's very easy to do something like a superimposed inflation calculation. So if you took the model that we had before, so this is a variation of model 3, I think, where we had the pooled estimate and we're taking effectively a last 4 continuance rate. If you shove in K there, which is our payment period, you're effectively getting an estimate of the superimposed inflation in your triangle. I've moved on to a payment triangle, I should have said, rather than a continuance rate triangle. You effectively get an estimate of your superimposed inflation in your triangle for free. So that's a useful thing to be able to do, and generally takes you a little bit more work to sort of get at that in your aggregate model. So being able to do that is useful. Being able to test a few different ideas is useful as well. So has the superimposed inflation changed over time? So you can sort of add splines and sort of test for sort of step changes in that. So if you've got your error distribution right, you can actually say, well, I think we genuinely have a change in superimposed inflation and make some conclusions. That said, the uncertainty of the superimposed inflation estimate is something you get as well, and often that's quite high. So my interpretation of that is that superimposed inflation is hard to estimate, which is a statistical interpretation of what everyone knows already, which is good, I guess, when it sort of agrees. And so that sort of gives you a little bit of, I guess, evidence when you talk to a client about, well, these things are actually quite hard to measure in terms of how claim costs are escalating. Sometimes they're quite hard to do. Another thing that's sort of quite important is how you sort of assess a GLM. So there are a few examples here of how you traditionally get taught to assess a GLM when you go to university. So you look at actual versus expecteds by row, and so I've converted the rows back to a triangle so you can sort of look at it visually. And so the idea is you don't want big patches of red or green. You can look at the parameter significance. So for each parameter in your model, you can say, well, what's its value? Is it significantly different from zero based on my p-value test? And there are other goodness of fit statistics, so the AIC, the deviance and chi-squareds and f-statistics, sort of various things that people have invented to test for goodness of fit. So after sort of studying these things for a while, the main observation is that most of these things are useless. And that sort of relates back to the fact that reserving is an extrapolation problem. So we're trying to apply it to a bottom half of a triangle. So no matter how well you fit the upper half, all that matters is how well you're projecting to the lower half. So I can produce 3 or 4 different fits that sort of look good on the AVE on the upper half of the triangle, and one will shoot up to infinity, one will shoot down to zero, and a couple might be in the middle. And I've got no way of distinguishing between those sort of options based on this statistic, which is a bit depressing. Similarly, when it comes to parameter significance, you might conclude a parameter is not significant, so I drop it from the model. However, that sort of moves you away from the continuance rate setup that we had in the aggregate model. So you're basically saying, I'm using this statistical test to deviate from what every other actuary does, which is a bold thing to do and often gets you into trouble. So I think that's one of the problems with GLMs as well, that the traditional statistics are all about trying to interpolate. So if you had a missing value in that cell and you wanted to know what it, in the upper half, and you wanted to know what it was, this would be a good way to do it, but it's not very good for the lower half. So the question is there a better way to do it? The answer is it's still a working process in my mind, open to suggestions. But here's a couple here that we sort of suggest in the paper. So one is actually do an actual versus expected, but on the bottom half of the triangle. And so to do that, then you actually need a reference model or a baseline model. So you might actually start with what you had last year. You might start with, I guess, a bog standard chain ladder as sort of a reference point to see whether you're pushing up or down relative to. And that's actually, if you keep track of that, that'll give you a much better sense of how you're sort of moving your reserve. And ultimately, the reserve is what you're interested in. Similarly, looking at cumulants is often very important. And so this idea is common to aggregate models as well. So you can multiply your continuance rates together column by column. And so you're saying for a claim that's active, looking at the bottom row there, for a claim that's active at zero, 27 of them will still be active at sort of development year four, 25 will still be active at development year five. And so being able to look at how those rows evolve, both the historical and the projected, gives you a sense of sort of whether you're skewing down or skewing up relative to the history. And there are good reasons why you may or may not want to do that. So if you build that into your GLM, and that's one of the first things you look at, then that's a useful thing to do. Another thing that's quite useful is the residual correlation. So I'm talking about the correlation between the continuance rate model and the payments model, and so you need that pair to sort of produce an estimate. So often you do see correlations, and they usually tell you a few things. So if they happen, if you have big step changes at the same time, means something odd's happened in your system, you might need to pay special attention. Similarly, it might sort of suggest areas where you need to add a little bit of complexity to your model where you haven't had it before, if you get sort of consistent periods of sort of highs in some areas. So that sort of gives you extra information that you didn't have before. This is sort of a fairly esoteric one, but I mentioned before that you need a link function to take you from your prediction from your linear predictor, so your covariates, to your prediction, whether that's your number of claims there or a continuance rate or your payment. And I said the default is the exponential function because it takes it makes everything positive, and continuance rates and payments are usually positive. One drawback of the exponential shape is that it increases exponentially. So in particular, actuaries don't like pushing continuance rates much higher than one. But if you are in sort of a situation where you've got a model where you've got a few cells where the continuance rate is higher than one, sometimes that can sneak through the model. The exponential effect kicks in, and so you actually get a little bit of wildness and volatility because those sort of unusual cells are sort of asserting themselves aggressively just because of that exponential function choice. So I don't really have a good answer to this, but there are options that are not exponential that might make more sense. So the scaled logic function, so the logic function basically takes a value between 0 and 1. You may want to adopt a model where you are allowed a continuance rate slightly higher than 1. So by choosing a number k that might be sort of 1.5 or 2, you're effectively capping your continuance rate, and that's a good way of sort of controlling that exponential effect. Another option is that sort of tempered log link where you've got the exponential function up until the continuance rate equals 1 and then linear thereafter, and that'll actually control some of that sort of exponential excitement. So there's a chart, because I haven't done a chart yet, so there you go. You can see an exponential line grows faster than a linear line or a line that is capped. Another thing that I haven't seen, but people would have thought of themselves perhaps, is that when you look at the payments per active claim model itself, and you've got something that's relatively stable like weekly benefits, you often see sort of an increasing shape. So you see lower benefits in the first couple of development years, and then they sort of get higher as you go along and stabilise a bit. And the reason why it has that shape is not because people who go back to work quicker are paid less, and so they have an incentive to. It's much more that the people who go back to work quicker, more people go back to work in those first few development periods, and because of that, they only receive half a year's worth of payments in that development year rather than a full year, and that artificially drags down the average in that column. So the point of this slide is to say, well, you can actually incorporate what you know about continuance rates and apply that in the payment model. And so if you had an average payment rate of P star, which is your payment rate if everybody continued every quarter, which would be a fairly unsustainable scheme, then there is a relationship between P star and what you actually observe, P. And that's basically a function of the sort of continuance rate and the underlying P star. So the idea is that for everyone who doesn't continue, they receive half a period, and for everyone who does continue, they receive a full period worth of payments. And so if you incorporate those factors, so the factor is 1 plus CJ on 2, into your payment model and effectively scale up your payments, instead of getting this upward slope curve that you model, you actually get something that's flat. And that is actually a little bit more useful to talk about, so you can say, well, people who continue tend to have higher or lower salaries, and you can actually make that conclusion. Or you can sort of say other things that are, I guess you've sort of removed one source of sort of signal from the model, so you can sort of zero in on other sources of variation over development periods. So again, simple idea. And I think this is just about the last slide. So I guess one of the main objections, which is probably a fair one of GLMs, is that it's quite harder to do manual edits where you want to apply actuarial judgment, for lack of a better term. There are a couple of ways you can get around that. One is you can actually just build your GLM in a spreadsheet. So to build a GLM, you basically have to define the loss function. So look up Wikipedia, figure out what the Poisson loss function is, encode that formula in your spreadsheet and use Solver, and then you've got a GLM in a spreadsheet. So that's great. And once you do that, you can sort of build your GLM. You can see it. You can edit it just like you did before, but with a little bit more sophistication and understanding perhaps than you had before. The option that excites me a bit more is sort of you can actually enforce those priors and beliefs and judgments using, I guess, extensions to generalised linear models. So I'm not going to talk much about penalised regressions, but if that sort of function L was the loss function you had before, so that's what you're trying to maximise or minimise, I should say, you can actually just add anything you want to that loss function and minimise something a bit more complex. And so if you add a penalty factor and you say you don't want your CJ to get too far away from some preconceived CJ star that you've got in mind, you can actually just add that as a penalty function. If you optimise over that, and there are lots of packages that will do that for you, that'll actually give you a statistically coherent basis for sort of moving your CJs from what the raw GLM would tell you. And you actually are able to enforce those judgments. So you can say, effectively, I have a prior belief that CJ should be at this level, and I want to bias the model towards that. I think that's quite a powerful idea. It's sort of quite sort of deeply linked to credibility and prior beliefs, I guess, in traditional actuarial work. But I guess, blending that with the GLM setup is quite a powerful idea as well. So that's about it. Thank you very much for listening. I guess the conclusions is that GLMs shouldn't be scary. They're not always needed. I think that the reasons we looked at the start, why people don't use them, are actually good reasons in many cases. So I'm not trying to be preachy. But I guess in terms of sort of pushing forward, the GLMs aren't that scary. There are ways to reproduce exactly what you did in Excel in a GLM setup, and it gives you a lot more power too. So I haven't tried to upsell the benefits of GLMs, so in terms of building super complex ones that tell you about error distributions and confidence margins and so forth, but that's all there. There is also the potential to build in extra factors, and so one good example of that is claimant age. Because triangles only allow you to model in two dimensions, when people ask you about a third dimension, so what does age have to do with it, for instance, the actuary has to go away and do a side analysis. You can actually build that into a GLM, and you can actually, there's no reason why you have to limit yourself to accident year and development year, and you can actually sort of improve your model over time and improve your understanding of a scheme. The other advantage I haven't really talked about is the stochastic nature of estimation, so understanding that variability and giving, I guess, a client a confidence interval around all your predictions is something in theory you can do as well. So I guess that sort of means that maybe the barriers to adoption are falling, but, I mean, there's not a huge lot of momentum that I've witnessed around this particular topic. So once again, thank you very much for listening. I hope you've learnt something or have been refreshed about something.
So if we could open it up to questions, if I could just ask you to come to the mic, clearly state your name, and ask any questions. I will start. Look, first of all, I guess I'd like to congratulate you on reflecting on techniques and actually innovating, because I guess that's one of our worries, that we just sit in our laurels too much. I guess one of my questions would be is, and I remember reading somewhere, you know, if the actuarial profession started yesterday, would we have ever come up with chain ladders, or would we have just quickly leapfrogged to something else? Are you actually seeing more innovation internationally on reserving methods? And You know, although you're saying you don't see much momentum, you know, we've seen radical changes in premium rating and other areas of disruption. And I'm just wondering, is this an area where you see we will see change, in, even if it's 10 years' time?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Internationally, it sort of varies, but sort of not a lot. I guess my personal impression is that the valuation side and the reserving side is kind of the boring side, and so you sort of get that over with as quickly as you can. And then if you want to do something sexy and data analytics-y, then you sort of do that at a claims triage level or some other sort of pricing premium level and do all your work there. I've been invited to speak at the plenary tomorrow afternoon for reasons that I don't fully understand. And I'll present a slightly sort of broader vision of how you could actually use the valuation a bit more sort of usefully, I guess, to sort of answer some of those scheme questions in ways that sort of current models and even sort of this GLM is still effectively an aggregate model don't really do. So I see a lot of potential in that space. Sort of the valuation could be a more useful tool. In terms of would we have the same sorts of models if we were to start again, I think the short answer is we'd actually end up making a lot of mistakes and ending up with something fairly similar to what we have now. So there was quite an interesting exercise where that Taylor Fry was involved in once that I observed but wasn't directly involved in, where a client wasn't convinced about a claims reserve and hired a non-actuarial statistician to say, what's my claim reserve? And so the statistician sort of thought about it and said, oh, yeah, I understand claim reserving, and had built a set of models and produced a very different answer. And so that was sort of interesting. And so, well, who's right? And so we sort of sat down, looked at the ways that our sort of, it was an aggregate model we were comparing against, the limitations of that compared to, I guess, what the statistician had produced. And sort of, I guess the point is that the statistician was very wrong. And I mean, I'm a trained statistician as well, so I'm not trying to sort of denigrate the profession. But the understanding of accident year and development year is actually very fundamental to reserving. So if you sort of don't get that right, then everything else falls apart. And I think that's sort of something I've learned as well. So when I presented this here, I didn't say fit a fancy GLM and everything will be fine. What I've effectively been saying, I think, is you can build a GLM. I think it's useful and probably a fun thing to do. But your starting point should still actually probably be something similar to what you had before. So I've been able to reproduce the reserving triangles rather than sort of come up with something that produces a completely different answer and argue that the different answer is better.
I'm going to... does anyone else have a question? Great, because otherwise I'm going to ask another one.
So it's Fickle from Suncorp. I've had several troubles using the PPAC model. So one of those is PPAC only models regular periodic payments, and there's some sort of a substitution effect between, you know, the periodic payments and other types of payments, and often there is a big disconnect because you do them separately. And how do you account for that? So that's question one. Question two, I think, is the distortion by frequency. So often you got different the claim size distribution could vary by quite a bit across different accident periods. And in years where you have a very high number of claims, many of those claims could be very simple, and therefore the continuous rate would be quite different. And often I find myself, I think there's more stability in the triangle by just looking at how many claims will remain at the end of that particular development period, which is essentially just making up numbers, than you know, applying a continuous rate to for the projection. The third problem I have is the importance the importance of the factors by development period are extremely different. Like, you change the development factor at the end by a little bit, doesn't really matter. And you change the first one by 0.1 or 0.01, it gives you an extremely different answer. And just wondering, I just find it quite difficult to use it for projection purposes. Mm-hmm. So I can sort of use it as a display, as a, you know, data information stuff, but I don't know how informative the PPAC model is in terms of actually informing the reserve.
Thank you for those questions. That's sort of very insightful comments, which is the type of thing to say when you're buying time and sort of thinking about what you're going to say for the answer. But they are sort of very good comments. I guess there are a few answers to that. So one is the continuance rate versus the number of claims directly. I think I sort of alluded to that in my talk, that sometimes looking at the number of claims active rather than the continuance rate can be an easier way to do it. I think that the GLM is not a bad tool for thinking about that too. Your first comment was about payment types. So I think my first answer is I've sort of chosen PPACs because I like them and to make everything concrete. A lot of the arguments about GLMs and sort of how they work would apply to other types of models too, sort of very equivalently, so like a payment per claim finalised model or something else. So I guess I'm sort of not sort of tying my post to the PPACs in particular, but your observation that traditionally you sort of apply a PPAC to weekly benefits, then apply something else to common law lump sums or something, and then you've sort of got these independent models which you know are kind of related because if one goes up, one should go down, but you don't have an automatic or a good way of sort of building that into your triangles unless you're really smart. So I completely agree with that. I would encourage you to come to the plenary tomorrow where I will undercut what I've talked about today by talking about something better. Perhaps. The other comment, was there one about sort of volatility in payment size?
Volatility, or more so about the dominance of the first few factors.
So the PPAC model is very, very sensitive to the first few continuance rate assumptions. So generally the get out of jail free card there is that they are also supported by much more data, so they should actually be more stable over time. So that does help a little bit. But you do have weird situations where, for whatever reason, claims managers are closing claims in the first year much more than they used to. And so you sort of get these sharp trends downward or upward in the first couple of columns, and then when you sort of look at those cumulants that I mentioned before, you get something which is way down or way up, and you know the answer's wrong. I guess sort of one thing you can do is maybe appeal to some of those diagnostics I mentioned before, that if you are making a dramatic change to your reserve accidentally, at least you'll identify it that way and at least try and understand what might be going on. Other than that, I think just acknowledging your comment is right, that it is a very sensitive model. I sort of sometimes think of it as sort of trying to draw with a whiteboard pen attached to a 2-metre ruler, that sort of every little movement you make at one end sort of makes a big difference at the other end.
You mentioned the fact of it's really a two-way table when you're doing, I guess, you know, your price or your reserving. I guess I'm just wondering, in something like an investment valuation approach that actuaries are increasingly getting involved in, where you've got a lot more data variables and data factors around age or different things, does the GLM and predicting that feature become much more useful? Is that where it'll end up going?
Yeah, that's right. And so that is sort of what I'll try and argue tomorrow to some extent, maybe poorly. So I guess the advantage of a GLM is you can build more things into it. So if you want to build in age, if you want to build payments to dates, if you want to build durations into last payment, in theory you can add all those factors in. To do that, effectively you have to go from that aggregate method to an individual method. So instead of having one row per cell, you need one row per individual. And so the amount of data we collect sort of now enables that, and a lot of the work I do in sort of the government space, which you're alluding to, is actually doing that sort of GLM building, which is still effectively continuance rate modelling in a sense. It's sort of predicting what will happen to someone next quarter based on this quarter. But doing that at an individual level and incorporating a whole bunch of sort of new variables that add extra insight. So once you've got that, just like you chain together columns in our picture that we had today, you can chain together a pathway at an individual level. And that gives you a reserve because you just need to add the numbers up as you did before. And that's actually, I think, a better way of doing it often because you'll actually get an understanding at an individual level, and often you'll get more accuracy because of the information at the cost of complexity and effort, I guess. Thank you.
Can I have a follow-up question on that, your response? So,
yep.
Because we've just seen that the competence level of those projections are very low, So would there be, so it's a similar problem with the big data. So it feeds in whatever number of, indefinite number of data into the model, and would it just result in an overfit? Like you come up with something that completely fits your statistical model, but it's just because there are too many variables to begin with.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. My answer is no. So any fit, in a GLM context, you can sort of automatically check whether you're overfitting or not, because you do get those p-values and things. You can do formal statistical tests as to whether you are overfitting. So you can control it that way. So I guess the observation is if you've only got 1,000 claims, there are complexity limits that you'll hit up against very quickly, because there's sort of not enough data there to sort of say, well, being called Bob is an important factor or not. But if you've got 100,000 claims or a million claims, then you can actually start to draw some of those things out. So it does depend on the data set you've got. I guess the other argument is if you're sort of building the complexity, don't some things shoot off to infinity and some things shoot down? My experience is that's less of the case. So one of the reasons why the reactivation, deactivation model I mentioned before doesn't work is because it completely ignores time since last active. So once you include time since last active as a variable, you actually get very low reactivation rates for claims that have been inactive for 10 years, and you get much higher reactivation rates for claims that you only just closed, which is an obvious thing, but it's something you can't really build into that triangle, but you can build into a more complex model. So those are the times when the complexity adds stability rather than detracting from it. I think that's enough. Yeah.
I'd like to ask everybody to thank Hugh for a really interesting presentation, and thanks for reviewing our techniques and advancing the profession in our thinking. Thank you.